You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news in technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with just a quick announcement. If you enjoy this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and support the podcast by donating to our annual fundraising drive at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show.
Accidental president. That's what they'll say.
I have a genuine desire to unite people.
LBJ wants our support. We're going to hold his feet to the fire.
Everybody wants power. Everybody thinks it ought to be given out like Mardi Gras beads.
A Democratic president ignoring his own party. Shameful.
You have to decide how you want history to remember you.
That was a trailer for the new HBO film All the Way, which follows a year in the life of President Lyndon Johnson, from the assassination of John F. Kennedy through Johnson's passage of the Civil Rights Act and his eventual re-election. It stars Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad fame in what will certainly be an award-winning performance as LBJ, and I predict another Emmy for my guest today, the film's director, Jay Roach. Jay has directed some of the best-loved comedy features of the past 20 years, including all three Austin Powers movies, Meet the Parents and the sequel Meet the Fockers, Mystery Alaska, Dinner for Schmucks, and The Campaign. He also produced such films as Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Borat, Bruno, and Sisters. More recently, Jay Roach's work has taken on a decidedly political tone. He directed last year's critically acclaimed film Trumbo, in which Bryan Cranston played the blacklisted screenwriter of the same name. Plus, he directed and produced the movie adaptations of John Heilman and Mark Halperin's bestsellers Recount, about the 2000 presidential election, and Game Change, which followed the 2008 McCain-Palin campaign. Both of those films for HBO earned Jay Roach Emmy Awards for Outstanding Directing for a Miniseries, Movie, or Dramatic Special, and for Overall Outstanding Miniseries or Movie. Game Change also garnered him a Peabody Award and a Golden Globe for Best Miniseries or Television Film. Now, Jay Roach returns to politics in his new film, All the Way, also for HBO. And today, we'll discuss where his interest in political subject matter comes from. We'll talk about some of Lyndon Johnson's infamous and even bizarre negotiating tactics. We'll discuss why LBJ took a huge political risk in fighting for the Civil Rights Act, and how it nearly led to the South walking out on him at the Democratic National Convention. Plus, we'll talk about his complicated relationships with Martin Luther King, Hubert Humphrey, his wife, and J. Edgar Hoover. And we'll ponder whether LBJ, the ultimate Washington insider, would survive or thrive in today's anti-establishment political climate. Coming up with director Jay Roach in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is the director of such modern comedy classics as the Austin Powers trilogy, Meet the Parents, and its sequel, Meet the Fockers, as well as last year's critically acclaimed movie, Trumbo. He's won Emmys for his more politically charged movies, Recount and Game Change for HBO, and he's dipping back into the political well for his newest film for HBO called All the Way, starring the brilliant Bryan Cranston as President Lyndon Johnson. Jay Roach, thanks for coming by.
It's great to be here, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into All the Way, I just want to tell you, when I was a film student at USC, just a few years after you, actually, you ruined a holiday party I threw once. A friend of mine, Philippa Burgess, who I think she worked for Doug McLaren at ICM.
Yes.
And she brought a VHS tape of the extended trailer for this new movie, Austin Powers. This was months before the movie came out, and no one had even heard of Austin Powers. We laughed our asses off, but then every time someone walked into my Christmas party, we had to stop everything and show them the Austin Powers trailer again. And this happened for like 15, 20 times throughout the whole evening. We had to drop everything. Everyone had to hush and stop talking.
That's so, really, that's funny. That. You know, that video was leaked completely illegally by my agents, and they didn't tell me they were doing it. And I kept hearing about it, you know, and it was like a 5-minute teaser thing. And thank God they did, because it never tested well. And the studio, I think, always wondered if
really?
It was going to work. Yeah, it never tested above like a 55, which is, you know, most films would be buried if they didn't test above 70, because it was such a specific, slightly weird vibe, especially based on what Mike Myers had done before. And so the studio started hearing about it through this leaked pirated tape that people would just call up and say, oh, I just saw this thing. And so they thought, well, maybe there is something, you know, an acquired taste, because it was already getting a kind of a buzz around town. And I think it actually saved us. We might never have gotten out if it hadn't been for that tape you saw.
Well, yeah. And I think it was the previous holiday that the big VHS tape that everyone was circulating around was the South Park guys.
Right.
That's right. George Clooney South Park Christmas video.
Yeah. Wasn't that Santa Claus versus Jesus?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think that we were going circulating all these things on, you know, homemade VHS those days, pre-YouTube. Well, you know, I know that I think that you're a Democrat. I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
You're a Democrat. Okay. I thought so. But you know who's a huge Austin Powers fan? George W. Bush.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yes, I've heard that. Yes. he's liked Meet the Parents too. We kept hearing.
Did he really?
So I was like, okay, well, maybe we have more in common than I might have expected.
Well, yeah, because I'm from Texas, and I kind of knew him, and I remember he was always going around, yeah, baby, Shagadelic,
oh my
yeah,
gosh,
baby.
That's great. That's
hilarious. But he was doing it like 4 or 5 years after the movie came out.
So hey, man, there's hope that comedy can unify us. You know, that's a pipe dream, but maybe there's something to it.
Yeah. Well, since you brought that up, your biggest feature film hits have been comedies like Austin Powers and Meet the Parents. But your films for HBO, which include Recount and Game Change, both of which won Emmys, two Emmys, I think, mm-hmm. for you, each of them, mm-hmm. and now All the Way, have been quite politically charged. Were you always this political, or is this something that came with maturity? How did this come about?
Well, it's funny you were mentioning Texas earlier. My father is from Texas, and he's conservative, and my family is kind of a whole mixed up political, you know, array of highly charged opinions. So I spent a lot of my youth arguing about politics, and I don't know what the instinct was. I think because I related so much with my mom, and she was a little more progressive, and anyway, I just grew up arguing, and it drove curiosity, but it also made me think a lot harder about what mattered, why I did care about some of these issues, and why I would be so intense with it with my dad. We still argue intensively. He, when I made the Sarah Palin movie, he said, "Now you don't go messing with our Sarah," you know. And so we,
oh hell,
yeah. I knew I was stepping into something, but he actually liked the film because, you know, we did help people connect to what it was like to go through what she went through. And you know, a lot of people on the right liked Recount too, because, in all of these films, I just try to get the story right. I certainly have a worldview, but it's mostly important to me to just tell a story to try to get to the truth of what happened, the authentic experience of what these characters were going through. And that's really the best you can do. You can never get to some sort of moment-to-moment, fact-by-fact accuracy because you're doing a two-hour movie. They're actors. You're on sets. It's all, to some extent, make-believe. But if you work at it and you really make just get it right your mantra, then you can get close. You can get it, and hopefully you can at least spark conversation, be entertaining. I try to work a little humor into these stories once in a while because politics has absurdity and irony and even ridiculousness sometimes. So the comedy training helped. But I really think it all started with just, just defending my worldview and being anxious about it. I'm always nervous about where are we going? How did we get here? And can it go a little better? And so that's what drives the interest.
Well, was it success that made you feel a little more comfortable having a political voice and putting it out there?
You know, I worked in, I was pre-law in college and I studied economics. I got a degree in economics and I was interested in politics. I was a student politico in high school. I didn't go into that so much in college. And actually in college, as I started studying economics, I was also doing work study, working my way through school in the film department at Stanford. It was a small documentary department, but it was a really cool group of people. And I cleaned the sound heads, on the editing desks and editing machines. And I just started getting tempted by the storytelling aspect. Somehow telling stories about politics seemed as interesting as politics itself. And so I came out of film school. I went to USC film school and then I came out and was writing a lot more serious material, sci-fi and things that were more connected to the things that I later got into. And it just so happened that years later, I got this break to do Austin Powers. So the comedy thing was more the diversion in a way.
Okay.
And I was sort of waiting to get a chance to get back into more serious stuff.
Okay. So you're getting back to your roots then, to some
extent. In a way, yeah.
Where in Texas were you from?
I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but both my parents are from, they met in Amarillo. Dad's family is from down in the Midland, Odessa area, San Angelo.
Okay.
And my mom spent her whole life in Amarillo, Texas.
Okay. An Amarillo romance.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good that your dad thought that you were fair to Sarah Palin. A lot of people gave you, I think, a lot of flack for that. I didn't think that it was a particularly unsympathetic or unfair portrayal, but I have to say it must be nice to deal with characters who are mostly dead in this film and can't take any issue with your portrayal of them.
There are always people who care deeply about how, especially iconic characters are portrayed.
Yeah, true.
And by the way, most of the flack we got on the Palin movie were from people that worked, for her. We didn't get that much flack even from the right because there were some people. I mean, the whole story takes place from the point of view of the Republicans who worked on the McCain-Palin campaign.
Right.
So there were a lot of Republicans who really loved that movie because they saw the kind of catastrophe that nearly happened and were wondering, how did we, the GOP, get to this place? And it's interesting in relation to the Trump situation now because in a way Palin paved the way for the kind of campaign he's running. So I think there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who had issues with that approach. So but on this film, there are people who care very much about how LBJ is portrayed and how Dr. Martin Luther King is portrayed.
True.
So we had a fairly daunting, predicament going into this to just try to get it right. But I had seen the play. I had seen it twice, actually.
That's right. It's based on a play.
Yeah. Based on a great play by Robert Schenken. It won a Tony Award for the play, and Cranston won a Tony Award for portraying LBJ. I got to see it while I was prepping for Trumbo, which is the film I made last year. And during that time, Spielberg and HBO came to me and said, would you direct the adaptation of of All the Way, I said yes, even not knowing whether Trumbo would go well. I was hoping Brian would and I would get along, and we did, and that's how it happened.
Yeah, I noticed that Steven Spielberg was an executive producer on this. What was his involvement with this project?
He saw the play. DreamWorks brought, they sort of talked to the playwright and got the rights and teamed up with HBO, got Schenken to do the screenplay, adapting his own play. And I don't know exactly when he decided that he I think he might have just thought about directing it for a while, but I've known him for some time. He was involved in Meet the Parents. He was actually for a while thinking about directing that as well. So I'm happy to get Steven Spielberg's hand-me-downs.
Oh yeah, those are good. You know,
a couple of good ones.
People have won Oscars with Steve Spielberg's hand-me-downs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So and I admire him. He's been a mentor figure for me and has always been supportive of the political films as well. He's obviously, as you see in the films he's done, like Lincoln and Schindler's List, he's very interested in politics. Yeah. And so he approached me and said, would you take this on? And he stayed involved. He read drafts. He watched many of the cuts, had fantastic notes in the edit, was helpful in some of the casting ideas as well. So yeah, it was a fantastic collaboration.
Well, yeah. And when I was watching it, one thing it reminded me of was Lincoln, because it's that rare glimpse into the political side of people that you know, but you don't really know. That insider's look at the actual horse trading, the wheeling and dealing, the smoky back room. And I loved that.
And also the psychology, you know, it is great. Film can take you into the back rooms. That's why I have made all of these films, because I always say I want to be in the room where they decided, you know, to have Sarah Palin be the vice presidential candidate. I want to be in the rooms when they're fighting over the idea of whether hand counting in the recount was somehow, you know, inappropriate. And in this case, I wanted to be in the rooms where LBJ, after achieving the dream he chased for his entire life, which was to be president of the United States, becomes president, but in the worst possible situation after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And then, instead of shrinking back, takes on one of the most combustible issues of the time, which was civil rights, and decides to go against his Southern brethren to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that I love about this movie is it's the version of LBJ that I've always wanted to see, because if you ever talk to anyone who ever actually dealt with LBJ, they would tell you his greatest strength was he was this brilliant master horse trader who knew how to get his way. And aside from the arc of civil rights, for me, this was really a master class in the exercise of political power.
That's right. He had been in the House of Representatives as a representative for a dozen years, another dozen years as a U.S. senator, and had become the Senate majority leader. So he was one of the most powerful and capable people, and maybe one of the most capable Senate majority leaders of all time. He had engineered so much legislation, and then he kind of stepped back, frankly, when he became vice president under Kennedy. And then when Kennedy passes, he reconnects with all of that ability to you know, finagle, horse trade, pressure. He used to get in people's faces and deliver what's called the Johnson
the
treatment.
Johnson treatment, yeah.
Or the Texas twist, you know, where he would get about half an inch from your nose and flatter you at first and make you laugh with really off-color jokes, and then eventually have his way with you, basically, and get you to sign on to his agenda.
Yeah, I love that you've included some of my favorite anecdotes about LBJ. There's one story of him when he's in a meeting, and I think in your version, it's with Hubert Humphrey.
That's right.
And he's in the middle of a meeting, and he just says, you know, come with me, follow me. He proceeds to go to the bathroom and literally start taking a dump and says, oh, go on. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a guy who knew how to put you in your place real quick.
Yeah, I think, I mean, those are definitely apocryphal stories of his, and it's hard to imagine someone being so uninhibited. There are so many more that were even, kind of blood-curdling, that, including forcing some of his colleagues to go skinny dipping with him, and then, making fun of the comparison between their private parts.
Yeah, he was very
parts.
Proud of his male member, wasn't he?
His Johnson was legendary.
He used to call it Jumbo, I think, I read.
Johnson's Jumbo. he was not afraid to use, in a way, they were all part of the manipulation, he would joke with you, prank you, get you off balance. Mm-hmm. He also famously would, drive around, have you go on a drive in his convertible, drinking, driving 90 miles an hour on a road, and then suddenly veer off, and go into a lake and reveal that his car was amphibious, and just to mess with you, and then start to get into, after you kind of got your wits back together after being scared to death, start to force you into a negotiation. So it was all part of that very, very capable legislative kind of back and forth that I think is a lost mm-hmm. art.
Yeah, it is. And contrary to, I think, a lot of people's popular imagination, it wasn't just bluster and beating people down. There was the other side, and there's a scene in there that I like because I think it shows this. There's this rare moment of deference on his part when he's sitting down with Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and it's almost barely perceptible, but it's in the White House, and the butler brings in tea to the Oval Office, and LBJ dismisses the butler, and then he pours the tea for Martin Luther King himself. And it's such a little thing, but I think it says a hell of a lot about him.
That's really perceptive of you to catch that detail. It's an African-American butler who right. also has a little exchange of looks with King right before. Johnson knows what's going on, and he wants Dr. King to trust him, and he knows he doesn't. Johnson had been involved in civil rights legislation in the past. Much of it had been watered down because it was impossible to get civil rights legislation passed through the House, which was run by the Dixiecrats, the strong conservative Democrats at the time, which is hard to picture now, but that's how that party had been set up. And 1964 actually changed all that. But he knew King wasn't sure he could trust Johnson to follow through. King had been disappointed by president after president, and even JFK, who was an advocate of civil rights, had failed to get it passed. And Johnson knew he was going to use this tragedy that had befallen the country and the goodwill that came out in reaction as everyone tried to stick together and hold the country together to do real legislation that wasn't just political expediency for him. It actually was risky for him to go against the South and improve the quality of life of African Americans and all Americans, really, with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And he needed King to trust him, so he was willing to put himself on an equal footing.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with director Jay Roach. Back in just a moment. Hey, folks. Do you like reading, but find it harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work, or working out at the gym, or relaxing in the bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics, then be a part of what I'm doing here and help us raise our production budget for 2016 by donating to our annual fundraising drive at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Thanks for listening. And now back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking with director Jay Roach about his new movie All the Way for HBO. Well, Jay, the movie follows a year in the life of Lyndon Johnson from the moment he takes over as president when JFK is assassinated through the passage of the Civil Rights Bill and through his fight to get reelected, or really elected, because he had never been actually elected before.
Right.
And he's very aware of that. He's an unelected president a year from reelection, and he knows civil rights is a third rail for many in his own party. So why did he decide to take this on? Was it personal or was it political for him?
I think it was a combination, but I think it was mostly personal. There's a scene in our film where he describes his experience as a high school teacher, straight out of college, teaching Mexican kids in a small school in Cotulla, Texas, and how he saw their eagerness to learn sort of disappear over time as they realized that they were going to be discriminated against just because of the color of their skin.
Yeah.
And you see, he delivers that speech in a press conference, so you know, there would be a temptation to think, well, it's just a political posture. But he truly felt it, and the reason I believe that is because he really was taking a huge risk. He was the accidental president. He knew he was seen that way, and he knew he was the usurper to the throne in a very Shakespearean way, by the way. His predecessors murdered in Texas. The brother, you know, in a way, seemed to be the heir to that throne.
Yeah.
He's suspected. He's, you know, he's the Texan come to the north, you know, all those things. And so it was kind of Shakespearean. But he chose to do, instead of consolidating power, they say power reveals character. He chose to use his power to right a decades-long injustice, or centuries-long injustice in our country, and help all people who would be victims of discrimination by taking on this thing, and instantly was attacked intensely by his former colleagues, including his former mentor, Senator Dick Russell, who Frank Langella plays in our film.
Yeah, and you know, he grew up in poverty, so I guess there was kind of this sense of him being on the side of the underdog throughout his life.
I think that's, he always felt like the underdog, even though he had been in very powerful positions. He hadn't gone to a fancy college, for example, and that was a real source of pride for him in a certain way, with all the Harvard-educated Eastern intellectuals. But he also did relate with people who were sort of kept under the boot, you know, and he needed, Dr. King and all the civil rights leaders were going to be his allies. I mean, he definitely did not do this alone. There was a tremendous force in the South, led by Dr. King, but other leaders as well. And one of the great things I love about Shankin's script was that you see Dr. King is being pulled in all different directions by the more conservative NAACP, by the more radical Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses. And he's trying to figure out how to deliver what he's promised Johnson, which is to keep things, you know, to keep the fire on down there, but not so much fire that it got out of control. And Johnson needed him for that. So I love the collaboration Shankin writes into to tell that story.
It's an interesting parallel because in some ways they're kind of in the same position.
Absolutely.
With their own constituency. Yeah, I really did love that. And, you know, the other great thing is it's only kind of dropped in here and there throughout the film. But for the audience watching in full hindsight, there's this ticking time bomb of Vietnam, because you know the moment that breaks out, it's going to suck up all the oxygen and they're going to miss their moment to pass civil rights.
Yeah, you definitely know. You're absolutely on top of what happened with LBJ. We have a tough time looking backwards and seeing through Vietnam to these earlier years of LBJ's because of what happened. And it became, you know, so much of the problem for Johnson that, of course, by 1968, he's so unpopular, and his health is flagging, and he chooses not to run. And it was a major thing to because he had done so much incredible legislation in his first couple of years. So it is, we do we do show the beginnings of the escalation because we do cover the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We have Bradley Whitford plays Hubert Humphrey. I have this incredible cast, which I felt so lucky to assemble. Bradley Whitford, who, you know, he's so great at playing the kind of guy he really is, but he completely transforms into Hubert Humphrey before your eyes, who's such a great character. Melissa Leo plays Lady Bird, Frank Langella, I mentioned, plays Dick Russell.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen Root plays my favorite Hoover that I've seen. I really love what he did, how strange and intense Hoover becomes with Stephen Root.
And it's interesting, that relationship, because Hoover's kind of intimidated by LBJ. And I think LBJ must have been the only president who could intimidate Hoover, who had lifetime security, basically, because he had so much dirt on everyone.
Yep.
LBJ had mistresses and skeletons. Mm-hmm. How come he wasn't intimidated by Hoover?
That's a really good question. It makes you wonder if they might have been a little more, you know, in league with each other than any of us knew at any point in their past. But I honestly don't know the answer to that. I do think that Hoover defied LBJ and wiretapped King to such an extent, even trying to get at his personal life, which Johnson thought was a terrible idea. So as much as he pretends to be serving the president obediently in the film, there's also, it's clear that he's got his own agenda. And by the end of the film, he does a very, very dark thing in relation to Martin Luther King, which I won't give up in case people don't remember it. But he as you know, it's been an age old thing in our country to tar any progressive movement, you know, having just worked on the Trumbo movie with attacks of being communist. People wouldn't be rising up against our great system if they hadn't been infiltrated by foreigners with a foreign idea. And that's, you know, that's the propaganda.
Yeah. And toward the end of the movie, there's a great scene there with Hoover that I just love, because, you know, and this is an incident that people forget about, but LBJ's right-hand man, I think, what was his name?
Walter Jenkins.
Walter Jenkins gets arrested by Vice Squad for, he's in a men's room and he has a little dalliance with another guy.
Yeah.
LBJ is shocked by this, you know, and he's known this guy his whole life. He says to Herbert Hoover, he says, how do you know? How can you, you know, he's just so shocked. How can you tell, Edgar? How can you tell these guys?
Yeah,
you know?
It's one of the most incredible stories. That moment is interesting because obviously Hoover, who had a very intense sort of witch hunt for homosexuals throughout his entire career with his own closeted life. But that story of Walter Jenkins is one of the great subplots of the movie. I think it could actually be a whole movie unto itself, because he had been Johnson's aide since 1938 and had helped him win and serve in the House of Representatives, win and serve in the Senate, helped him as vice president, and now was essentially his chief of staff. Bill Moyers told me if he hadn't been thrown under the bus once he was caught in that YMCA and sort of fired because he was gay, Vietnam might have never happened, because he was his closest confidant outside of Lady Bird.
Yeah.
And Johnson was constantly, you know, being harangued by McNamara and all the other generals, who would always, of course, say, this time, even though we failed this last time, we'll get it right. We'll just throw in more troops and we'll get it right. We'll shock and awe them and we'll get out, win and get out, you know. And Walter Jenkins had been a guy to say, are these guys for real? Is this something I should, you know? And he was a great counterbalance to those other opinions. Whether that's true, I'm sure Mr. Moyers is speculating, obviously, but he was that close, is all I'm saying. And it was such a tragic story
to him.
He actually ends up going back to Austin with his family. I think he became an accountant. And if I'm not mistaken, LBJ reconnected with him when he went back to Austin after he retired.
Okay. Well, you know, back in the days before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he had the perfect excuse to get out of the draft. So that was probably the best time to come out, I think.
It was a tough time to be homosexual, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, throughout the movie, you see LBJ treat poor Hubert Humphrey terribly. Mm-hmm. And the guy who eventually became his running mate, he treats him like total crap, like he's a redheaded stepchild. Did they become close, or was Humphrey just a political tool for LBJ to placate the liberal wing of the party?
I think that LBJ was often he would manipulate people as needed to accomplish the ends he sought. And fortunately, most of the things he sought were very, very constructive goals. He passed some of the most incredible legislation since FDR. He passed Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, doubled the education budget, increased spending on infrastructure, like an incredible array of things that actually improve the lives of people. And to do that, he was always, sometimes even bullying people. And in the case of Humphrey, he suspected he would be his vice president. He knew that to win over the liberals, which he would desperately need if he was going to lose the South, Humphrey would be the perfect guy. But he wasn't entirely comfortable with the choice, and he dangled it in front of Humphrey until the very last second. Yeah. I don't think Humphrey knew, even as he was flying to the convention, for sure that he was going to be the VP choice. And I think it's just, again, people describe LBJ as being in so many different things, kind and cruel, competent and, dysfunctional, like a whole range of unbelievable adjectives. And one of them was occasionally being, a bully, So
occasionally.
But out of love, he loved his country, and he would bully you to get it. But not, sometimes more selfishly, too, I'm sure.
Well, in his personal life, you see him snapping at Lady Bird, his wife, a lot. And there's a scene with his daughter that seems to indicate that they probably didn't have too much of a relationship. Was he better at fostering political relationships than real relationships?
It depends on who you talk to, I think. He's certainly another Moyers quote that Robert Chenkin told me was that I never liked the man very much, but I loved him. And I think that's he was, I can relate in a certain way to that Texas masculinity. My own father was raised on ranches all throughout Texas. And there is a kind of fighter, survivor, a pioneer spirit that was different than the way men are today. And he was very much a throwback. Fathers weren't sometimes as close to their kids, and especially working fathers who worked insane hours. And it was actually Brian's idea to put in that scene where he speaks to his daughter, and you get a sense of, wow, he might be sacrificing a lot to be the leader of the free world.
Yeah. And you see that in Trumbo, too.
Yeah,
Brian.
Absolutely. And again, very similar in that way that it was just because Trumbo's daughters described it to us that way, that he was a kind of old-fashioned father where kids were to be seen and not heard. I heard that a lot when I was a kid. That's why kids are to be seen and not heard. Well, that you wouldn't hear that in a typical progressive school in California these days.
And it's interesting that you went into filmmaking.
Yeah. Well, again, I think I was rebelling. I wanted to tell stories, and for a while I was supposed to be seen and not heard.
Well, you mentioned earlier Dick Russell, Senator Dick Russell, who was LBJ's mentor and kind of one of his best friends. And he was a Dixiecrat, and he has a tough time with the civil rights legislation. There's a little bit of a question as to what his motivation was, whether he was a racist or whether it was states' rights and so forth. And there is a scene where Senator Russell, played brilliantly by Frank Langella, talks about mourning the passing of civility and etiquette and process in the Senate and party loyalty.
Yep.
And I think people forget that in the days of LBJ and Russell, it wasn't all this acrimony and bitterness. The Senate was supposed to be the civilized place.
Yeah. I wonder if there was a certain amount of, like we've talked about, a compromise and horse trading. But there was quite a bit of conflict as well. And as we all know, whenever you're the person, whenever your cause is what you're talking about, it's the civil, patriotic cause. And I do think that Russell who was a segregationist through and through, there's no question about that, believed that segregation somehow was part of protecting some old code, some old social order, not appreciating how much that social order had depended on abusing an entire group of people, an entire race, an entire group of Americans, of human beings. And that was a consciousness Johnson did not accept. And that is, that relationship with Russell and Johnson is a father-son story. I love my father, and I've learned a tremendous amount about honor, honesty, hard work, incredible values. But I did see growing up that his political philosophies were so radically different from mine, and I couldn't figure it out. And that's, again, partly why I tell these stories, is I just want to understand the psychology. I do judge to some extent. I can't help that. But I mostly want to just understand.
Yeah. And on a certain level, it seems that he has this love of the process of the Senate.
Yes.
But I'll be interested to see how the movie is received by the public. I know the critics are going to love it because it's just absolutely excellent. But I'd be interested to see what the public thinks in this political environment, because he was the ultimate Washington insider, smoky backroom deals and all. And right now, both sides, there seems to be much anti-Washington, anti-establishment anger. Everyone mm-hmm. seems to want an outsider, whether it's Bernie or Trump. Do you get a sense that LBJ would probably have a tough time today?
It's interesting. I think he might have a tough time, although if anybody could navigate a complicated set of forces that were in opposition, he would be one of your better choices, because he actually had that much experience. People look down on experience now in Washington. Having experience in Washington is a negative.
Yeah.
For Johnson, it was a huge positive. He knew what mattered. He knew what was at stake for every senator. He knew their wives. He knew their kids. He knew them as people, as opposed to as the enemy. And that ability to treat people like people, as opposed to just a member of the opposite party, he would excel at. And the thing that you brought up, such an important point, important to me, is that there is a tendency now to delegitimize government to such an extent that it is that campaign to do so is kind of fulfilling its own prophecy, because as you keep electing people who don't trust government to go into government and don't think it's going to do any good, they will make it as dysfunctional as they have promised it will be. And I if this film does nothing else, I hope it reminds people that there is a possibility. When good people are elected, good government can happen. And it's not about small government or big government. It's about better government. Shouldn't there be, since it's the people we elect, it's for us, it's our government, shouldn't we try to figure out a way to re-legitimize, public service and the power of the government to improve the quality of our lives? LBJ did that. You may disagree with how he did it, but he cared about that. And I think there's such a, and I, to be honest, I think it mostly comes from the right, that the instinct to perpetually look at, as Ronald Reagan said, government as the problem and not the solution. But government only exists to create solutions. That's all it's for. And if you lose faith in that, then what's left?
And, you know, we were talking off mic earlier, and I was telling you, I had Senators Trent Lott and Tom Daschle in a while back, and they were talking about how they lived in Washington. They hung out with each other's families. In service of their constituents, they spent all their time in Washington because that's where things got done, and they
Absolutely.
Got to know the people they were dealing with.
That was LBJ, too. He didn't do anything else. He didn't read books. He didn't go to movies. He didn't do anything but politics. Yeah. Even when he went back to his ranch, it was just known as the Western White House.
Well, I'm curious, as a director and a writer, what do you look for in a story in general?
The reason I've migrated to these kinds of stories, I think, is that they are so layered. They are about flawed and competent people with complicated psychologies and even philosophies and spirituality. It's about the soul of the character, but it's set against these very high stakes predicaments that a whole nation finds itself in. And that, that to me is great storytelling. It's something you learn reading, you know, classic theater of Shakespeare and the Greek theater, the Greeks. You want stories to work at every possible level. And I think that's how you create suspense. And if they're also about things that matter and help you work out your own relationship to these issues, then I just think it's more engaging to have things be working at so many different levels.
Before we go, just to throw back to your last film, when you were writing and directing Trumbo, did you find yourself thinking, my God, 50 years ago, this could have been me?
I loved that as well. I didn't write it. I just directed a John McNamara, the great, in a movie about screenwriters. I have to quickly throw the big screenplay credit to John McNamara.
Okay.
But both of us would have been blacklisted 50 years ago. There's no question about it, especially making a movie about the blacklist, exposing the persecution of people just for their political beliefs. It would have gotten you blacklisted. Lee Grant was blacklisted for 12 years of her incredible acting career because she went to a funeral for a blacklisted writer and implied that the stress of being blacklisted killed him.
Yeah. Well, J. Edgar Hoover probably wouldn't have been your friend, I imagine.
He would have had a big file on me by now. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Jay Roach, the film is just fantastic. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's called All the Way. When does it premiere on HBO?
On May 21st, Saturday night.
Terrific. We got to see this movie, folks. Jay Roach, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ben. Great, great interview. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Jay Roach for coming on the show. All the Way airs on Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Or you can watch it anytime with a subscription to HBO Go or HBO Now. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis. And thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.